From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, tracking down one of America's most wanted computer outlaws. Kevin Mitnick stole information worth millions of dollars from corporate and personal computers and eluded the FBI for 2 years. His big mistake was breaking into the files of computer security expert Tsutomu Shimomura. Shimomura used his computer expertise to track down Mitnick through the internet and lead the FBI to him. We'll talk with Shimomura, and New York Times reporter John Markoff have collaborated on the new book, Takedown. Also, we talk with Hanif Qureshi about his new novel set in a London community of Islamic fundamentalists. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Salman Rushdie's new novel, The Moor's Last Sigh. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. GOP congressional leaders unexpectedly canceled today's scheduled budget talks with President Clinton. The Republicans said Mr. Clinton must first put a firm budget offer on the table and move toward what they called bipartisan common ground before the negotiations can continue. But a White House spokesman said Mr. Clinton has already shown flexibility in the talks and questioned whether a new administration proposal would lead to any progress. A Republican commission chaired by former Housing Secretary Jack Kemp has recommended moving the country to a flat tax system, but the panel steered clear of suggesting a specific rate and sidestepped some controversial proposals such as eliminating deductions for mortgage interest. Security is tight today around the federal courthouse in New York City, where 10 men convicted of a plot to bomb the United Nations and several other landmarks are being sentenced. Among the men is the radical Muslim Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman. From member station WNYC, Laura Seidel reports.
The first five defendants received 25 to 35 years from Judge Michael Mukasey. Mukasey told one defendant, "You agreed to participate in a conspiracy to commit monstrous crime." The defendants continued to maintain their innocence. During the sentencing, Victor Alvarez said, "I am not a crazy man. I never knew of any plot to bomb anything in the United States." Among the defendants is El Sayed Nosair, who was also convicted in this trial of the 1990 assassination of the extremist Rabbi Meir Kahana, and Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, who federal prosecutors say directed the plot to bomb New York City landmarks. Police barricades and concrete barriers surround the Manhattan federal courthouse. Bomb-sniffing dogs went through the federal courthouse this morning. Although demonstrations were expected, there were no protesters outside the building. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Seidel in New York.
Former U.S. Congresswoman Barbara Jordan has died. She was the first black elected to Congress from the South since Reconstruction. She gained national prominence during the 1974 congressional hearings on whether to impeach President Nixon. During those proceedings, she made stirring remarks about her unshakable faith in the Constitution. Barbara Jordan was 59. Cheaper commodity prices managed to drag a key economic figure down in November. The index of leading economic indicators fell 0.3% to its lowest level in nearly 2 years. Analyst Nancy Kimmelman explains.
We've seen in the last couple of months, leaders, which is made up of 11 different components, we've had, you know, about half of them have been on the increase and about half have been on the decline. And when you do get a big change in any one component, like we saw in sensitive material prices, it tends to push the fulcrum off-center, and in this case, to a negative 0.3 reading.
But Kimmelman says three of the 11 components that make up the index were unavailable because of the recent government shutdown. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up just over 2 points at 5,090 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The engineer of the commuter train that hit a school bus in Illinois last fall says he slammed on the brakes, sounded the whistle, and prayed that the bus would move. The bus had stopped for a traffic light, but it had not cleared the tracks. Seven high school students were killed. The engineer's testimony came on the first day of a National Transportation Safety Board hearing. The Iraqi government is denying a report that it's ready to discuss a deal with the United Nations on relaxing the terms of its economic embargo. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Iraqi officials in Baghdad say there has been no change in their position to oppose a UN resolution to allow them to sell $1.6 billion in oil to pay for imports of food and medicine. The denial follows reports from the UN that Iraqi representatives have told diplomats from non-aligned countries that Baghdad is ready to discuss relaxing economic sanctions. Iraq has recently increased its calls for the five-year-old sanctions to be lifted. Until now, it has refused a UN deal, claiming that the terms violate its sovereignty. The UN imposed an economic embargo against Iraq after its invasion of Kuwait. The sanctions have remained intact because of Iraq's failure to fully comply with UN resolutions to dismantle its biological, chemical, nuclear, and long-range missile programs. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
The former presidential aide who fired White House travel office workers says he felt pressure from the First Lady to dismiss them, but David Watkins told a House hearing today that Hillary Rodham Clinton did not actually order the firings. The U.S. has decided to honor a request by China to recall a military attaché accused by the Chinese government of spying. Lieutenant Colonel Bradley Gurdes was detained last week. He says he was questioned continuously for 19 hours and denied food. The State Department says Gurdes' detainment was a violation of conventions on diplomatic immunity. Some officials feel the incident was China's way of retaliating for the administration's recent decision to grant a transit visa to Taiwan's vice president. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Kevin Mitnick was one of the most wanted computer criminals in America in late 1994 when he did something foolish. He broke into the computers of a computer security expert named Tsutomu Shimomura. Of course, at the time, Shimomura had no idea who was behind the break-in, but he was determined to find out. Using state-of-the-art detection techniques on the Internet, Shimomura tracked down Mitnick and then led the FBI to him. Shimomura tells the story in his new book, Takedown. He is my guest, along with his co-writer, John Markoff, who writes about computers and technology for the New York Times. Markoff devoted part of his earlier book, Cyberpunk, to Mitnick. In fact, Mitnick once broke into Markoff's computer and stole his email. Mitnick's other crimes include breaking into a North American Air Defense Command computer, gaining temporary control of three phone company offices in Manhattan, and secretly reading the email of computer security officials at MCI. Shimomura found out that his stolen files were secretly stashed on the online service known as The Well. I asked him why he wanted to go after the thief himself.
Well, first I was asked by The Well to assist in this when my files showed up at The Well. I was asked to help them out as a personal favor. And other part was whoever was doing this, we didn't know it was Kevin at the time. It seemed that it would be easier to go find him or them and stop him or them rather than clean up after them forever. Every time there's a break-in, there's a lot of work involved in finding out how the break-in was done, what damage has been done, what backdoors, what additional means have been put in for the intruder to get back in, etc. And finding those and cleaning up afterwards can be a great deal of work. And in a lot of ways, just finding someone who's doing that and stopping them may be easier in some ways.
Now, John Markoff, you write about computers and cyberculture for the New York Times. What was your role in this investigation?
Well, my role was a reporter covering a story. Tsutomu called me on January 17th, and he told me that there was this new flaw, this new type of attack on the Internet called IP spoofing, and he felt that it needed to be publicized, that the computer emergency response team was not moving quickly enough. And I wrote a story about the attack and the type of attack and the attack on Tsutomu's machine in particular that appeared in the New York Times on January 23rd.
Now, what was new about this attack?
Well, the attack itself was not new in the sense that the computer security world knew about it. In fact, the attack had first been discovered or created by a young man by the name of Robert Tappan Morris when he was at Bell Labs as an intern many years before. What was new is it had never been seen in the wild, and many of the systems on the Internet were potentially vulnerable to it.
Tsutomu, when you decided to go after this computer criminal yourself, what kind of interactions did you have with the FBI?
I'd had interactions with the FBI before on other cases, most notably some break-ins in 1991 from Dutch computer crackers to U.S. military and government computers during the Gulf War. This time, I didn't initially go to the FBI because my experience had been pretty negative. They weren't really aggressive in pursuing these guys, and it seemed to me that you either went after these guys or you didn't. There was no halfway. This time, FBI, and particularly the Justice Department, was really the Justice Department, both out of Washington and U.S. attorneys, were quite gung-ho about going after whoever was conducting these break-ins. And that gave me the feeling that there was actually a chance that we might actually catch someone.
Mm-hmm. I'd like one of you to explain in lay terms one or two of the computer forensic techniques that you used to track down Kevin Mitnick, to figure out that he was the person responsible for the break-ins.
Most computers record when files are modified. If you go and modify a file or modify a directory, it records a time when that modification happened. Some computers record last time a file was accessed. And so by looking at the times files were accessed, if you look across the entire system and see what files were accessed, you can get an idea as to what happened when. If you put these in order, you can see, well, gee, this person was in this directory looking at these files at this time, then he went to this directory and was looking at these files, then he copied these files off.
Now, how did you find that the person who was checking up on these files was him?
We watched this behavior, and at another site, Netcom, we were able to monitor a electronic chat session between this person and someone else in which he complained about John Markoff having put his picture on the front page of the New York Times.
So, bingo.
Yeah.
You figured out that it was Kevin Mitnick. And then what? Did you get a warrant for his arrest?
Well, at that point, we still had to go track him down. We had no idea as to where he was. And it was a matter of tracking his electronic signals through the network, tracking his bits through the network, trying to figure out where they're coming from. And initially going over the internet, then over Netcom's network, then over the telephone network, then over the cellular network. And at each step, getting court orders or warrants as necessary.
When he got to court, Kevin Mitnick said to you, Satumu, he said, "I respect your skills."
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any respect for his skills?
Not a whole lot. Because, well, I don't respect his technical expertise, having watched what he does. He's more a con man and grifter than a programmer or real hacker, I think. His real skills lie in manipulating people and systems of people and persuading people to do things, persuading people to give him access rather than actually doing anything new, creative, imaginative on computers.
What kind of people did he persuade to hand over information?
He was a fugitive several years ago. There was a large cellular telephone company in San Diego that found that somebody had stolen all of their source code. The source code is the programmer's original instructions for their new digital cellular telephone. And when they went back and figured out how he had done it, what it appears happened is that somebody had gone through their trash and found an employee newsletter that listed all of the new employees. Well, if you're a new employee and somebody calls you up and they say, "Well, I'm traveling and I'm on the road and I forgot my password, and will you give me the password to the system you're working on?" You tend to want to be helpful. And in fact, a new employee did give him a password, and this company lost all of their source code.
So he's really good at talking people into doing things.
In the computer underground, they call it social engineering, and that involves pretending that you're somebody other than you are, knowing how to talk the jargon, and getting information.
So what did he want from your files in the first place, Satumu?
I'm a security researcher, and Kevin Mitnick was aware of this. And my guess is that he thought that I might have information or software tools that someone might have given to me, or perhaps even tools or something, things that could be turned into tools for breaking into machines to give him further access. Because it seemed that he was systematically going after people who wrote security-related software.
So what were the charges against Mitnick? What was he found guilty of?
Well, Kevin Mitnick was arrested in Raleigh, North Carolina in February of last year, and he pled guilty to one charge of telecommunications fraud and was sentenced to 8 months. But unfortunately for Kevin, that's not his only legal entanglement. The other charges are being consolidated against him. He's now in jail in Los Angeles in the Metropolitan Detention Center, and he has a court hearing on January 29th. And he will either plead to charges from as many as 8 federal districts, the California DMV, and the U.S. Marshals Service, amongst other things, or he will go to trial.
I think it's fair to say that the kind of cyber thievery that Mitnick was responsible for is a relatively new phenomenon, or at least it's happening more often now. I think there's some controversy behind the approach to sentencing of people like Mitnick who invade other people's files. You know, some people think that the charge should depend on what they did with the files. Did they use it for damage in damaging ways, or did they just go into the files and look around?
Well, we have a lot of that in the real world, right, already. There isn't anything, I think, intrinsically different in that way about the online world, you know, what we call cyberspace.
Mm-hmm.
There's the same notion, or there should be, of ethics, right and wrong, morality. Some people have the attitude of, well, because I can, I may. That's like my saying to you, since I can break into your house, I should be allowed to break into your house. Or saying, well, it's okay for me to break into your house as long as I don't take anything. But, well, it's okay for me to take pictures. And, oh, by the way, it's okay for me to give those pictures away or sell them. And in the real world, we wouldn't put up with that. And by the same token, I don't see why we should put up with that in the electronic realm.
Was breaking into machines a hobby for him? What he'd broken into other files over the years, including John Markoff's. Did he do evil things with the information once he got it, or did he just like to break into places?
I don't know if there's an easy explanation for that kind of behavior, because clearly he knew what the penalties were. He knew what the stakes were. He was clearly living out some sort of a fantasy. I mean, at different times he took the code name of two different Robert Redford movie characters. He was called Condor once from 3 Days of the Condor. And when Satomo began watching him at Netcom, he was using a code name Marty, which was a name that belonged to Redford in the movie Sneakers. So, you know, I think Kevin Mitnick may have seen himself as some sort of outlaw in some, you know, larger-than-life movie. Clearly, he was targeting the best computer security people in the Internet and trying to find out what was in their files, looking for flaws, looking for ways to get into other systems.
So, Tommy, you know, it strikes me you're in your early 30s, right?
Right.
And you've been deeply involved with computers since your teens.
I've been a user since, I don't know, for about 20 years, I guess, give or take.
Yeah. Now, that's something you really have in common with the computer outlaw that you tracked down, Kevin Mitnick. He's in his early 30s. He's been using computers since his teens, but he's been breaking into them, too. So you both have something in common, but you represent, you know, complete opposite ends of the cyber world spectrum.
I guess so. I've always been interested. Now, I've been trained as a scientist. I've always wanted to be a scientist, and that's what I do now. I'm a researcher. And I've always been interested in what's true and learning what's true. And that's always been what's been most interesting to me. I haven't had much interest in manipulating other things or having control over other things, which I think perhaps Kevin Mitnick did. I think my personal guess is that he had a great interest in having control and power over other people. And that's probably what drove him to do a lot of what he did. One more comment about Kevin. I don't have a very good feeling for who Kevin Mitnick is. I know him sort of as my quarry for a while. I've read books about him. I've read articles about him. But the most insight that I'm able to get out of him has been from listening to him interact with people, watching him converse with people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably what's helped me the most get into his head, and to the extent that I have, and to try to understand him a little bit. And a lot of this information we have and we've made available, and some has been made available, some of it is in the process of being made available on our website, which is www.takedown.com. There you'll find voice calls of Kevin Mitnick trying to social engineer, as he puts it, information out of people, and also online talk sessions, chat sessions, where he's conversing with people trying to get information out of them or trying to persuade them to give him tools. And I found that looking through this was a much more... that nobody really speaks better for Kevin Mitnick than Kevin himself.
Do you think that Kevin Mitnick is, in a way, the wave of the future? Should we all be bracing ourselves for a crime wave on the Internet? Or is he an example of just, you know, the odd guy who breaks the law and breaks the rules, and you know, he's dealt with, and that's that?
I think it's somewhere in between. Kevin Mitnick, I think, is a warning of the world we're entering into. I don't think Kevin is a horrible electronic terrorist. He didn't destroy lots of computer data. However, I think he points the way to understanding what kind of vulnerabilities are out there. If you go to a place like the Computer Emergency Response Team and you ask them to give you sort of their incident statistics, you find that computer crime incidents, break-ins over the internet, have actually been going up just at the same rate that new people have been, you know, joining the internet. And so, once again, it's an issue where this cyberspace world is more and more mirroring the physical world.
You know, it seems to me that both of you might be particularly outraged at Kevin Mitnick's computer thievery, because he represents a kind of breaching of cyber world culture. I mean, for a long time, I think things were a lot safer in cyberspace. And every time that cyber code is broken, people feel, I think, less and less confident about the security in the cyber world. In other words, what might have been a kind of utopia is changing.
I think that's very true. The first 20 or even 25 years of the ARPANET and then the internet really was a special time, and it was a special community, and it was a community based largely on trust. And the more incidents like ones where people break into other computers and steal people's electronic mail, the more incidents there are like that, the more the walls go up. And the more the walls go up, the more we lose community. And I think that's what we've seen in the last 5 years, particularly in the internet.
My guests are New York Times reporter John Markoff and computer security expert Tsutomu Shimomura. They collaborated on the new book, Takedown, The Pursuit and Capture of Kevin Mitnick, America's Most Wanted Computer Outlaw. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with computer security expert Tsutomu Shimomura and New York Times reporter John Markoff. I'd like to ask you both what you think is the most interesting thing on the horizon in the computer world for average users. In other words, what do you think we're going to be doing with our computers 5 years from now?
Probably the next significant thing is a real increase in bandwidth and the arrival of cable modems. And in a way, it's kind of sad to me because, in one sense, the internet has represented this throwback to a literary society, if you will. People have been writing letters, they've been reading. It's a little bit like it was in the 19th century. And with bandwidth, I'm afraid, and I may be proven wrong, but I'm afraid that we will be able to send, you know, little video snippets, little audio snippets, and people will be able to communicate by just speaking at each other again. And that the internet will change in some way that we don't really understand yet, but it won't be the same. And this literary society that's been recreated will vanish.
Now, what will it take for that to happen? Do the phone companies have to lay different wires down?
Well, there are huge infrastructure problems in front of us to get to that world I'm describing, but there are also huge incentives for both phone companies and cable companies to lay the infrastructure so they can deliver this stuff to people, to either to their television sets or to their personal computers. And that's all in place. I mean, even though the interactive television stuff has sort of been shelved, there's a huge race on to basically connect people to the internet with more bandwidth and offer these new multimedia services. And what they're going to look like is impossible to describe. But if you see what's happened over the last 3 or 4 years and the acceleration in the change in technology and the sort of instability in the industry, that's really quite remarkable. I mean, the emergence of companies like Netscape literally overnight and with a huge influence on the computer industry, you know, they may vanish as quickly as they came, and new things may emerge. And that's what's, I mean, for one thing, it's a full employment act for reporters, but it's also what's so remarkable about this technology is it really is totally unstable, and we have no idea what the world will look like in 5 years. And anybody who tries to be a visionary, you know, from Jim Clark to Bill Gates, is really quite at risk. You know, one of the things that makes this the most interesting time, I think, ever in the evolution of this technology is we're on this curve that is described as Moore's Law, and that is that, you know, every 18 months, the number of transistors on a given piece of silicon double. And we're really just on the interesting part of that curve. And so, you know, while people are quite impressed with the fact that they have Pentium computers and PowerPCs on their desktop, there are people in Silicon Valley that are designing single-chip computers that now operate at 10 gigaops, 10 billion operations a second, you know, dozens of times, an order of magnitude faster than the computers we have on our desks.
I've been reading about a so-called black box that might be available soon for about $500. John, could you explain what this is and how it might change things?
Yeah, people are talking about basically an internet terminal that will connect to the internet and not be a personal computer. And therefore, they hope it will be much cheaper than today's personal computer. And they also hope that it won't be made by Andy Grove and Bill Gates. I mean, there's a lot of political stuff going on in the computer industry. People are hoping that this technology will sort of destabilize the existing personal computer industry. And a lot of these things have to shake out. I mean, one of the problems with the $500 internet cruiser is that, you know, if they want you to use your television screen, I'm sorry, but it's not going to work very well because it's hard to look at text 14 feet away on your couch. You know, the right way to cruise the internet right now is sitting at your desktop and using a personal computer. But, you know, flat panel technology is changing quickly. Bandwidth is going up. And, you know, it may make sense to actually have just a window into the internet. It would certainly make sense if you could carry it around with you.
Go ahead.
Now, one feeling that I have, and one experiment that I've been trying for many years now, is, you know, we're used to telephones, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have telephones in our homes. We put them everywhere. You know, my hotel room has a telephone in the bathroom. And the general notion is you shouldn't have, you know, a telephone isn't some sacred object that you have one of in the house, at least not in this country. You put one anywhere where you might want to use a telephone, or you have a cordless phone which you carry around with you, or several in this case may be. And I think that web terminals, be they these network terminals that John's talking about or things that we use right now, be they personal computers, and I personally have a bunch of Spark stations at home that I scattered around anywhere I would put a telephone, I put a Spark station, or a high-performance workstation for accessing the web. But the notion is treat these things like telephones and see how we use them, if they're that convenient. The normal model, or the traditional model, has been that you go and sit down in front of the computer and get to work. My feeling is that the computer as a network terminal is a very different animal. It's something that helps you do whatever else you happen to be doing at the time. Working on the computer isn't really what you do. You're using the computer to facilitate you're doing something else. If I'm in the kitchen, I'm looking for a recipe for something that I don't have. I can search the web quickly and find, you know, 14 different recipes for banana bread or something. 12 which I've never seen before.
Computer security expert Tsutomu Shimomura and New York Times reporter John Markoff. They've collaborated on the new book, Takedown. They'll both be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Hanif Qureshi. His new novel is about the attraction of Islamic fundamentalism to young people. He says his novel grew out of his desire to understand the people who were calling for the death of Salman Rushdie. Rushdie has a new novel, and we have a review, and we continue our interview about computer security.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with computer security expert Tsutomu Shimomura and New York Times reporter John Markoff, who covers computers and communications technology. They've collaborated on the new book, Takedown, about how Shimomura tracked down one of America's most wanted computer thieves, Kevin Mitnick, after Mitnick broke into Shimomura's computers. I asked Shimomura and Markoff to look ahead a bit to the cyberspace of the near future. What do you think is the future of the big online services like America Online and CompuServe?
Oh, it's a very difficult situation for them now because they have to cease being islands and they have to become peninsulas. And look at what happened with Microsoft Network. I mean, no sooner had they introduced it and they wanted to make Microsoft Network very much like America Online or CompuServe or Prodigy. And unfortunately, we're moving from what might be called third-generation networks to fourth-generation networks. And the fourth-generation network is the Internet. And so these online service providers are scrambling like mad to try to differentiate themselves and add value. But it's very difficult because there's so much value in the web.
One of the amazing things about the Internet, again, is that it's worldwide. And there are standard protocols that let you talk to anyone anywhere else. And anyone can do an implementation of these. You don't have to go buy it from a particular company. It's competitive. You can buy the best implementation. You can buy your connectivity from the best provider locally from your viewpoint. And it's competitive. And this competitiveness really keeps people on edge, or keeps these guys on the ball, I think, which is something these large online providers often don't have. And I think it's very important to have these open protocols because a lot of companies feel they can get ahead by having a captive audience. And that may win in the short run, or seem to win in the short run, but in the long run, that always screws you.
There seems to be a lot of new online providers that are offering email and access to the Internet.
There are hundreds of them. I mean, there are dozens of them in every city, it seems like. Everybody who has a fast workstation can put it in their bedroom and run a couple phone lines in and become an Internet service provider. But over the next couple years, as the RBOCs, the regional Bell operating companies, get into the Internet business, I think we're going to see Internet service becoming a commodity. I mean, you know,
What do you mean?
Well, the price will just fall to perhaps nothing. It's possible that we may see Internet service being given away as a sort of incentive from a long-distance provider. Internet service will just sort of be something that you expect along the side, and it'll be a basic thing that you will get for free, and they will try to lure you to sort of go to their value-added services. But that's going to be a very tough situation for all these mom-and-pop Internet service providers who have sprung up and are now charging relatively a lot of money for basic Internet service. So like the rest of the computer industry, the Internet is going to be very unstable over the next 3 or 4 years. There's going to be a shakeout. The big RBOCs are going to come in. The cable companies are going to come in. Lots of people are going to invest billions of dollars in building infrastructure. And if you think about it, I mean, what does AT&T's revenue come from right now? Well, it comes mostly from, you know, selling voice calls, the voice call service. If you think about the kinds of bandwidth people are talking about, the ability to send billions of bits or millions of bits down a wire to your home, the amount of bits it takes to send a voice call is like a tiny little trickle compared to that stream of multimedia. So all of a sudden you get into this weird situation where the voice revenues are being charged totally out of balance to their value in the new world. And that's going to create a lot of dislocation, I think.
When you say they're being charged out of balance, that be charged too much, too little?
What I was saying was, I'm sorry, the price of voice service is going to be far out of line with the cost of multimedia service. And so this imbalance can't last. I mean, if you can sort of pop a little voice call along your cable modem line, why would you want to use the telephone network? I mean, already people are hooking up very simple telephones that go over standard low-cost, low-speed Internet modems that allow you to make free phone calls even overseas. So there's really a very interesting situation that's facing these large companies that want to deploy these networks. How do you price them? Nobody's got it figured out.
John, you recently covered in the New York Times a story about censorship on the Internet. There was a federal prosecutor in Germany who said that there was material on the Internet that violated German pornography laws. And because of that federal prosecutor, CompuServe an international online service temporarily blocked access to sexually explicit computer discussion groups. I want you to explain the story and its significance.
Well, the significance of the story revolves around the fact that the internet increasingly makes this one world. And we have many different cultures with many different value systems, and all of a sudden we're sharing an instantaneous communication system. And there are going to be increasing conflicts as, you know, one country's culture is fed into another country. The particular situation with CompuServe, I think, is one, and as a matter of fact, the entire problem, I think, ultimately can be resolved technologically rather than legally. There is actually already very good filtering software available for parental control. We're speaking particularly about the issue of pornography on the internet. It is possible to equip a personal computer with software that basically lets you see the net only selectively. And I think that that's a reasonable solution rather than, as some people in Congress are suggesting, banning pornography, trying to figure out, you know, what should and what should not be on the internet. It gets more dicey when we talk about political thought on the net. And I can foresee very, very difficult situations where one country may want to ban an entire sort of political part, an entire part of the political spectrum. And I'm not sure what will happen then.
What was the outcome of the Germany and CompuServe story?
I think CompuServe has been working to try to basically put systems in place that will allow them to selectively deliver content to different countries. And I think that will be their attempt to compromise with the German government.
What do you think the future of Apple Computer is? I think there's a lot of people wondering, you know, is Apple going to become obsolete?
Apple is in a great deal of difficulty. But what surprises me, I mean, I'm a reporter who has covered Apple since 1978, which almost goes all the way back. The company was founded in 1977. And Apple has gone through hard times many times before. You remember in 1985, the original founder of the company, Steve Jobs, was tossed out, and they had a restructuring, and they went through hard times again in 1990. The fact remains that the technology is solid. I mean, I think that the consensus of most people out there is that it is still better technology. There are still reasons to have Apple computers as opposed to PCs. And if anything, you know, there's not everybody in the world drives Chevrolets. I mean, there's some BMWs out there. Now, that may force Apple into a niche market, and it may be very difficult for them to find a way to survive in a niche. But it's not clear to me that the computer world should be entirely uniform, or that it has to be.
I just have one last question for each of you. What gives you the most pleasure on the internet now?
Well, I think it's using the internet as a tool. It becomes more useful for my work as a reporter every day. I mean, I can find sources, I can look up government records, I can find company information. You know, 3 years ago, I couldn't do that. I couldn't use the net in that way. And all of a sudden, it's this remarkable tool. And, you know, I dip into the internet, you know, 5, 10, 15 times a day just to look for information in a way that's becoming increasingly seamless. And, you know, it's a great tool.
Satoma?
For me, I take great pleasure in seeing so many companies, individuals, take pleasure in putting information on the net. They seem to think that it's important to do that and making this information available. And I think having information is a good thing. Education is a good thing. The ability to educate yourself and the ability for others to educate themselves is a wonderful thing. And I'm really glad to see that other people can see this as well, and that they're willing to put the extra effort in to make this information available, you know, about themselves, about others. And this is something that I've always wanted to get access to information. I've used commercial information service providers for a long time, been very frustrated often by very primitive user interfaces and closed systems. And these days, there are so many people competing to put information up and try to get the information looked at, that a lot of people are willing to put a lot of effort at trying to make their information a lot more accessible. And I think that's really wonderful.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Yeah, thank you.
Tsutomu Shimomura is a computer security expert. John Markoff covers the computer world for the New York Times. They've collaborated on the new book, Takedown. This is Fresh Air. Hanaf Qureishi is best known for his works about ethnic youth culture in London. His new novel, The Black Album, is about a college student of Pakistani descent caught up in two opposite worlds, the sex, drugs, music, literature, and rebellion of youth culture, and the orthodoxy of his Muslim fundamentalist friends. Like the main character, Shahid, Qureishi is a second-generation Pakistani living in London. Qureishi wrote the screenplays for the films My Beautiful Laundrette and Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. He wrote and directed the film London Kills Me. I asked Qureishi what attracted his main character to fundamentalists.
They have a great sense of purpose and of meaning. After the fatwa against Rushdie in 1989, I decided to find out what these kids wanted and why they wanted to kill a friend of mine who had written a book, The Satanic Verses. So I went to the mosques, and I went to the colleges, and I went to their houses, and some of the material has gone into this book. And I found, rather like Shahid, that a lot of these young kids who are involved in this kind of religion have a terrific sense of purpose and of meaning and of identity. They've suffered a lot from racism and prejudice and discrimination. Their religion gives them a whole way of understanding life, of seeing the world, and sometimes sitting amongst them, I really envied it. I thought, oh God, how wonderful to have such a simple view of the world, to have answers to every question.
No, I mean, your fiction has been very multicultural, in a sense that there's always people of different ethnic backgrounds in your book, people from different countries, people of different sexual orientations. And I'm wondering what it's like for you to, instead of kind of embracing multiculturalism, to feel so alienated by a group of people who you're writing about.
Well, at the same time, I did feel great sympathy, you know, for them. I could see that they were having a really hard time in the sense that...
You mean the young people who had gotten to London and were...
Yeah, the young kids who got involved in this kind of fundamentalism. After all, most Muslims are not fundamentalists, you know, any more than most Christians are fundamentalists. And most Muslims are pious and devout and are not interested in killing writers. But this particular group was, and they were the ones who, you know, who I was drawn to because of the fatwa. And I could see that they had terrible problems in terms of unemployment. Many of them were very bitter, you know. They felt their parents had come to England, their parents had worked really hard, but now many of them were unemployed. There wasn't much hope for them. What were they going to do, you know? And you could see that this kind of bitterness could easily spawn a kind of neo-fascist religion.
You know what I find interesting? I think a similar kind of bitterness, take away the ethnicity and the religion, helped fuel the very anarchic punk rock movement in the 70s, you know, unemployment, bitterness, alienation. And in this instance, it's helping to fuel religious fundamentalism, an opposite extreme.
Yes, it's very interesting that, yes. Well, yes, I was involved in punk, and I've written about punk in The Buddha of Suburbia. But I felt that punk was much more aimless, in a sense, and kind of a kind of meaningless thrash in the political sense. But I think these kids, you know, I think many of them will drop out of this way of seeing the world after a while. And many of them actually did come to me kind of secretly and say, you know, can you get us a job? You know, we know that you work in the media. Is there anything you can do for us? But I think the others could get into a lot of trouble through it, because you can't form these kind of politically motivated groups, as it were, and do nothing with them. In the Black Album, there are a number of events, particularly the end, a kind of a book burning. But you felt that they had a lot of energy, a lot of purpose, but there wasn't anything much for them to do, and they would have to look for something to do.
You write that in the book, that a lot of the young Muslims would even run out of a supermarket if there was music or Muzak playing in the market because they didn't want to be exposed to it. I'd like you to compare your view of art with the view of art that the young fundamentalists you observed had.
Well, yes, it is a very interesting conflict because they saw art somehow as a kind of corruption, you know, as a way of men and women expressing the impurities in their soul, whereas I see literature, music, painting, and architecture, etc., as a way in which we become fully human. You know, art is how we speak from the deepest parts of ourselves to the deepest parts of other people. Perhaps I'm an aesthetic fundamentalist in that sense. You know. Although it has always seemed to me that what men and women do, what men and women make when they write, when they paint, when they make music, is far greater than ascribing these qualities to some object or other called God. But of course, they found art only to be some sort of contamination, and that art kind of expressed all kinds of things that they didn't want said about themselves or that they wouldn't want to know about themselves. It's a terrible job being a Muslim fundamentalist because you have to, as it were, stamp on and repress and constrain almost every impulse that you have. It must be very hard work.
Do you feel that there was a lot of resistance to imagination in general?
Well, the imagination can do anything, can't it? The imagination can go anywhere. And that's why it's so terrifying and so exquisite and so beautiful at the same time. And you could see why they would want to rein it in. After all, once you start imagining, then you can imagine outside the system. And for them, the system was all.
Now, are you from a Muslim background?
I come from a kind of liberal, middle-class Indian family from Bombay who grew up amongst a whole range of crazy religions, but we really were not committed to any of them.
So did you grow up, you didn't grow up with any religion in the house?
I grew up with Islam in the sense that my father and my uncles used to mock it, used to laugh at the mullahs, you know, in the way that people might laugh at who were Catholics, laugh at the church or laugh at the Pope. But I was certainly not devout, so I found it rather difficult to imagine myself into the minds of some of these characters. You know, that I felt that was one of my jobs as a writer, to try and find out what these people's heads might be like.
Now, I believe your parents came to England in the 40s, and you were born in 53 or 54?
My dad came to England, yeah, at the end of the 40s, and married my English mother in the early 50s. Yeah, and I was born in 54.
So do you feel like what you went through and the confusion that you went through coming of age is very different from the young people who you're writing about?
Well, I was the only young Asian kid in my district, and I suffered from a lot of racism, a lot of violence. It was the age of the skinhead, you know, and many of my friends at school were skinheads, I suppose, rather like the Daniel Day-Lewis character in My Beautiful Laundrette. And there were right-wing orators and speeches by politicians like Enoch Powell and so on. So it was pretty heavy down there in those days. But it was also the 60s, you know, and the early 70s. So there was a sense of kind of liberation that pop music could make you free. There was the Beatles, drugs, sexuality, all that stuff was going on, which kind of seduced and enticed me. And I got away from the suburbs under that flag, as it were.
A lot of your fiction is about people who break the rules in one way or another, whether, you know, because of the way they live, whether it's because, you know, they're homeless or they use drugs or because of their sexual orientation or just the people who they relate with or whatever. And again, I'm interested in this idea of you always writing about people who break the rules, now writing about people who obsessively follow them.
Yes, I suppose that's right. It may be because I grew up in the 60s and 70s, where breaking the rules was obviously much more exciting than keeping them, and certainly much more exciting than making them. But as you say, being obsessed with people who like extreme fundamentalists, who lay down the law and follow it, as it were, to the letter, was fascinating to me because it was so different to me. I would be in a room with these kids and I would wonder why they didn't, you know, jump up and break the windows, let alone the rules, and why they were going along with in such a masochistic way with pieces of the religion that they didn't necessarily agree with. I would say to them, but you don't agree with this. This is obviously completely bonkers. And they would say, well, you know, you've got to swallow the whole lot. You can't just sip a bit of it. And that kind of masochism fascinated me because it certainly isn't anything, that, as you say, that I would put up with in my own life. And seeing what that sacrifice was for, i.e. going along with something that clearly you disagreed with in order to have, as it were, overall a better life, because, you know, it would be satisfying to believe in one big thing, was really fascinating to me. And I was interested in why that sacrifice would have to be, I would have to take place.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, anytime.
Hanif Qureshi's new novel is called The Black Album. Coming up, a review of Salman Rushdie's new novel. This is Fresh Air. Salman Rushdie's The Moor's Last Sigh is the first novel he's published since he went into hiding in 1989 after a death sentence was issued against him by the Iranian government in punishment for his allegedly blasphemous book, The Satanic Verses. He's using his current book tour as an opportunity to resurface, with the help, of course, of bodyguards. The Moor's Last Sigh has already won England's Whitbread Award, as well as censure from the Indian government for its satiric portrait of a fascist Hindu politician who seems to be based on the real-life Hindu nationalist leader Bal Thackeray. Book critic Maureen Corrigan read The Moor's Last Sigh to see what all the fuss is about. Here's her review.
Trying to give you a sense in 3 minutes of what The Moor's Last Sigh is like as a novel is like trying to fit the ocean into a bathtub. This is a novel so vast, so multitudinous, it tempts me to talk in lists in order to cover everything. Salman Rushdie writes about love denied, secrets, betrayals, murders, and the theme no doubt currently closest to his heart, exile. He slips into different genres as effortlessly as Imelda Marcos once slipped into high heels. We get passages written in the style of mock epics, gothic novels, political commentaries, mysteries, romances, magical realist romps, and early James Bond movies. Rushdie rivals Dickens in his inventiveness of plotting and Joyce in his cheekiness of wordplay. And in addition to everything else he includes here, Rushdie even supplies reviewers with the perfect blurb for his novel. There's a scene early on where a character surveys a mural and exclaims, "It is the very swarm of life itself." He took the words right out of my mouth. The hero of The Moor's Last Sigh is a melancholy man called Moore, whose strange fate it is to live his life at twice the normal speed. By the age of 7 and a half, he tells us, I had entered adolescence, developing face fuzz, an Adam's apple, a deep bass voice, and fully fledged male sexual organs and appetites. At 10, I was a child trapped in the 6'6" body of a 20-year-old giant, and possessed, from these early moments of self-consciousness, by a terror of running out of time. Moore is the last male child of a wealthy, star-crossed Indian family, descended on one side from the Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama, and on the other from the illicit union of a Sephardic Jew with the Sultan Boabdil of Granada, the last Moorish ruler to be expelled from Spain. In a narrative that flashes back over 100 years, Moore recounts his family's bizarre and sometimes brutal history. We learn about his great uncle, who on his wedding night put on his bride's wedding gown and ran off to meet his male lover. Moore reveals how his own father once made a pact to exchange his firstborn son for stolen emeralds, and how he himself eventually became an enforcer for a sadistic Hindu mob. Most of all, though, Moore's whirlwind narrative centers on his mother, Aurora, a beautiful, internationally famous artist whose lethal gravitational pull, he tells us, denied me all hope of escape. As a reader with an old-fashioned taste for realistic characters, I tend to be wary of Baroque tales like The Moor's Last Sigh, where the characters are so over the top, they're more like fairy tale figures than flesh-and-blood personalities. And to tell the truth, I never came to care about Moore the way I care about characters like, say, Lily Bart or even Alexander Portnoy. But Rushdie's narrative is so intricate, I soon found myself happily lost in the novel's twistings and turnings, even without the lure of a compelling main character as a guide. Many critics are hailing The Moor's Last Sigh as glorious proof that Rushdie's confinement hasn't weakened his novelistic gift. But I think you'd almost have to be in enforced solitude to sustain the concentration necessary to create such an ingenious, hyperabundant tale. Like his hero Moore, perhaps Rushdie feels his restricted life racing past him, and so in compensation, he's crammed this novel full of nearly everything, real or imagined, he believes the world has to offer.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.